This is Bill with another edition of What Makes Sense, featuring biblical citizenship from the Patriot Academy. In this edition of What Makes Sense, I'm reviewing some of the actionable suggestions coming out of the series we just completed. I'm also including opinions about some of the last session content based on my research. The assertion was made that the Noahide laws were the first earthly government established by God and were given to protect inalienable rights. In researching the Noahide laws, which I'd never really heard in that terminology, my conclusion is they are conceptually good but not completely biblical. These laws are part of Jewish tradition and were supposed to have been given to Noah after the Great Flood. Jewish scholars read quite a bit into what God told Noah in Genesis, perhaps integrating in some of the Ten Commandments given to Moses many years later. The Noahide laws are these. 1. Do not worship idols or other gods, but God alone. 2. Do not blaspheme God or use his name in vain. 3. Do not murder. This was a command explicitly given in Genesis when God says, "Whoever sheds human blood, by man his blood shall be shed." 4. Do not steal or covet or misrepresent. 5. Do not engage in adultery, incest, bestiality, or homosexuality. 6. Do not eat the flesh of living animals or be cruel to animals. At first glance, this seems like an odd law to include, but it's clearly recorded in Genesis where God tells Noah, quote, "You shall not eat flesh with its life." He says this right after telling Noah he may eat the flesh of animals. The Talmud writers concluded this was a commandment against cruelty. You may kill and eat animals, but not in a cruel manner. 7. Promote civil justice, including equal treatment and defending the innocent. You can see the relationship to the Ten Commandments with the possible exception of number 7. The Jewish people had a strong sense of justice and governing structures, and seemingly added the seventh law to reflect the right application of following God's commands. Following God's commands defends human life and inalienable right and results in a just society. Unfortunately for us, our nation has only fallen by one step. Our government has forgotten that there is a power higher than itself. This is a vital problem as government becomes increasingly secular. The difficulty of asserting God-given principles in a governing structure that is ignorant about God, doesn't believe he exists, and therefore believes God-given rights is merely a poetic phrase. It is why our efforts seem hopeless at times. We keep trying to win politically through political action without recognizing the worldview reason that makes our activism futile. Can this worldview impasse be overcome? The Bible suggests not. The Apostle Paul wrote in a letter to Timothy, "People will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, heartless, unappeasable, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not loving God, treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God." That's quite a condemnation. The Apostle Peter wrote that scoffers will come in the last days with skeptical hearts, following their own sinful desires. Scripture prophesies a time of tribulation when people's hearts grow cold. Jesus himself asks, "Will I find faith on the earth when I return?" None of this bodes well for a socio-political revolution in a positive direction, especially since our America isn't mentioned in biblical prophecy of the last days. Unless, of course, the mystery Babylon of Revelation refers to what America has become. But that's a discussion for another episode. But I can't leave these thoughts hanging. The Biblical Citizenship course advocates that we try to restore our government to constitutional principles, regardless of whether we can succeed. The Apostle Paul referred to this approach as running the race. He wrote in Hebrews 12, "Since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, Let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out before us. Christians need to live up to the legacy of those believers who came before us, that great cloud of witnesses. We are to throw off what discourages us and live as God has called us to encourage future generations with our godly example. It's not a matter of winning or losing, and in politics, we're called to stand for justice regardless of the outcome. Politics is about winning and losing. We're about righteousness. The First Amendment of the Constitution says Congress shall not prohibit the free exercise of religion. Taken in its totality, it is saying that Congress shall be neither for or against, but should be religion blind, just as it should be color blind. There should be no discrimination. America's first Supreme Court Justice John Jay concurred. Security under our Constitution is given to the rights of conscience and private judgment. They are by nature subject to no control but that of deity, and in that free situation they are now left. Unfortunately, non-Christians are also religious and want their religious views supported. It's important to understand there's no such thing as religious neutrality. Regardless of what secularists might say, removing God from our schools separates the acknowledgement of God from students and indoctrinates them in secularism. This wasn't always so. The modern legal system was established on biblical teaching. The phrase, the laws of nature and nature's God, came from Blackstone's commentaries on the law. Not on the biblical law, on the civil law. Blackstone taught that God revealed himself in nature and in his laws through the Holy Scriptures, and Blackstone's commentaries were the foundation of legal jurisprudence. Unfortunately, Blackstone has been replaced by case law and its humanist foundation. Judges now base their decisions on the previous rulings of other judges. It's a system of man-made law interpreted by men, with man's decisions passed to succeeding generations, with no reference to a higher authority. Although the average person may never have considered how modern law works, people are intuitively skeptical of such law because they know it's just the opinions of other people instead of representing any absolute standard like God's law. It's interesting that even atheists need an absolute standard for law, but they don't have the means to achieve it because they reject the absolute lawgiver. We were advised in the last session of Biblical Citizenship to promote Constitution Day, a celebration of the Constitution's birthday in our local public schools. We thought that would be easy in a freedom-loving, conservative community like ours, but not so fast. It turns out that Missouri law already requires that every student graduating from high school must pass a test on the Constitution. And our school already has a curriculum geared to passing the test. Why, then, do young people graduate from school leaning toward socialism? The test is very shallow. It's based on the questions asked of immigrants applying for citizenship and lacks the richness of what we learned in biblical citizenship about the Christian design of the Constitution or the godly character of the men who crafted it. The questions don't address the nuances of constitutional design, such as separation of powers and checks and balances. Some facts are there, but without the heart. Here's a simple question from the test. What are some ways that Americans can participate in their democracy? Let's ignore for a moment that we're not a democracy, we're a republic, but let's go ahead anyway. Suggested answers to that question include voting, joining a political party, helping a campaign, running for office, and calling for politicians. All of the pat answers anyone could suggest, I was kind of thrown by that one about joining a political party, but there it is. Here's another example. When is the deadline for sending in federal tax forms each year? Yep, we want everyone to know when to pay their taxes. Not exactly a key to understanding the intent of the founders, especially since there were no income taxes back then, but that's a whole other story also. Then they asked who lived in America before the Europeans arrived, Well, that has nothing to do with American government, but misdirects the teacher and students back to the idea of unjust beginnings. The test doesn't seem to answer the more important questions of how our system works, and how it contributes to liberty and justice, and how the founders, the crafters of this system, struggled with all the ideas of government to try to come up with the best ideas to make the freest possible society. This doesn't mean we should give up, but the fact that there is a standard in place makes it less obvious how to replace it with a better standard. The good news is that every measurement of student performance in civics reveals our students are pathetic, scoring significantly lower than the immigrants who take similar tests. It should be easy to convince schools that they need to teach civics more effectively and gear it toward a more comprehensive test. While we're at it, we might need to aim higher by suggesting a completely new K-12 curriculum in civics. Hillsdale College has produced such a curriculum, which they call the 1776 curriculum. To give you an idea of the high tone of this curriculum, the following is an excerpt from its introduction. "The pursuit of truth is an unapologetic pursuit. For those who strive for honesty, it cannot be otherwise. You, the teacher, should be aware of the truths which Hillsdale College holds to be accessible to human reason, proven through the ages and true of all people in all times. This curriculum is based on these truths. They are as follows," and I am paraphrasing them here for the sake of simplicity. "Truth is objective. Human nature is flawed and does not fundamentally change. Because of human nature, government will always be capable of tyranny and mismanagement. That individuals are responsible for their actions apart from any group affiliation. That the United States is unprecedented in the annals of human history for its extraordinary degree of freedom and prosperity, and that its principles are responsible for America being an exceptional good country. This is the kind of positive and truthful curriculum that can raise up a nation of unified and compassionate citizens. It focuses on the positive while leaving space to talk about the flaws we have overcome." That's quite a leap to go from Constitution Day to an entire K-12 civics curriculum. But big problems require big solutions. Our responsibility as Christians in our republic is to champion what is good regardless of the odds against us. Constitution Day might be an easy win, but no single day event can overcome the failure of the year-long curriculum currently in place. Our group is talking about how to implement the big picture correction in our local school. Maybe an administrator will see implementing the 1776 curriculum as a test whose success would be a great feather in his or her cap. Maybe then other districts would follow suit. Let's change gears. I bet everyone has been told at one time or another that voting doesn't matter because millions of people vote. I submit it's a poor argument. Voting is easy. You have to be pretty ignorant not to do it. This is especially true for Christians who at one time represented the majority in the United States. If all Christians voted as a bloc for one candidate for president, that candidate would win handily, even today when we are not the majority. The challenge of biblical citizenship is convincing spiritually minded people to perform a secular or worldly action, even when the result can have great spiritual import. This is why it is so important to present biblical citizenship to churches, because Christians are the most likely people to respond to the call for constitutional government. We need to mobilize. Biblical citizenship advises us to evaluate candidates and find good people to be candidates. The difficulty is that candidates rarely reveal who they really are. And I don't mean they are deliberately deceitful. Any candidate will try to figure out how to present themselves in the most positive way, so they pick and choose the ideas they highlight. We've all seen candidates whose campaign page proudly proclaims their conservative credentials, but the subject of a slogan might not be their primary goal once elected. It's a rare candidate that will campaign on a clear list of clearly stated goals, but that's what we need from a candidate. I'm talking about something more than a platform. I'm reminded of Newt Gingrich's contract with America, where he tried to create a sort of to-do list of commitments. We need more of that, and we need to keep track of whether they follow through. There is something difficult in this for conservatives, though. If a true conservative runs for president, a true conservative would run on a platform of reducing the power of the presidency. It would include statements like, I will not use executive orders to avoid enforcing laws. I will not order troops into action without a congressional declaration of war. I will disband the ATF and the Department of Education. In actual practice, the winners of elections, even conservatives, prefer an assertive president who enforces conservative ideas. Anyhow, electing good candidates is the general recommendation, but I have a specific one. A few years ago, I appointed myself the candidate research expert in my church and relied on a site called Ballotpedia. As we approached an election, I plugged each candidate name into Ballotpedia and usually got a page of information showing a general description, the candidate's website, social media links, and often a candidate survey. I used easy access to information to create a profile of each candidate's platform and goals and made a summary of each candidate organized by the office they were seeking. When I published my election document in church to church members, they were able to make an informed decision about each race. Anyone can perform this service for their circle of friends, and believe me, you will be thanked for it. Most of us want to make the best decision about the people running for office, but it's easy to get lost in the campaign rhetoric and media opinions. Be a Ballotpedia warrior for your circle of influence. Getting out the vote was another recommendation, but I would modify that. Let's not be naive and conduct a voter registration guide without regard to who will be registered to vote. I would prefer to get out the right vote. After all, if you're going to that effort in an election, you should want to win. Christian conservatives should focus on getting out the Christian conservative vote. The strategy should be to get them register and then remind them on the day of the election to vote. That's a winning strategy. It was also recommended to support legal organizations like the Liberty Council, First Liberty Institute, the Alliance Defending Freedom, ACLJ, Pacific Justice Institute, etc. These organizations and others defend religious liberty and are supported by donations. My advice is to pick an organization and support it well so that you can truly make a difference for that one organization. Then monitor what they do so you can be sure they are fulfilling their mission. America is a republic and not a democracy. Educate everyone you know about this important truth. It's an important distinction that isn't well understood. But the founders of America, the ones who carefully crafted American government, were strongly opposed to democracy. In a pure democracy, every decision is made by one vote more than 50%. One vote more. It's little different from a flip of the coin. Will it be an informed and thoughtful flip of the coin? Consider all of the decisions that made every day in local, state, and federal government, and imagine that you would participate in all of them in a pure democracy. You would be overwhelmed researching the substances of each of those decisions. You would probably turn out of desperation to some form of media or group of experts to inform you how to vote. But those sources are unelected people with their own agendas and not necessarily unbiased advisors, if there even is such a thing. In a pure democracy such as this, the real interests of the people are even less protected than in the system of elected representation in a republic. Because the typical person is busy with life, bad decisions are made in a pure democracy, and bad actors can sway the vote. In a republic, the people delegate the job of decision-making to an elected representative who has the time to investigate each issue and make informed decisions. In a republic, the people sacrifice their power in day-to-day decision-making, but reclaim it when election time comes around and they have a chance to either endorse or replace their elected representatives. A republican form of government is by no means perfect. elected officials become power hungry, or they are misdirected by lobbyists, or they can just be lazy and addicted to the easy life of officialdom. Nevertheless, representative government is an important improvement over democracy because it keeps citizens in ultimate control while shielding citizens from the overwhelming burden of participation. The biblical citizenship class advises us to advocate for Article 5 and Convention of States. Are you fed up with our runaway government? Many people I talk with are frustrated by national politics because the power of the federal government seems so distant from the people, and there seems little we can do to rein in abuses of that power. What we forget is that the structure of the American system has the solution. Local state governments created our national government with limited powers. The states conceived of the federal government as little more than a referee to ensure cooperation among the sovereign states. We can use the innate authority of our local state government, therefore, to restore the balance between federal regulation and local sovereignty. The states have the right to regulate federal power through a mechanism provided in the federal constitution. We can use it to mandate fiscal responsibility, reduce interference in local affairs, and reverse the relentless expansion of regulation that harms our local economy. Here is our two-part strategy to finally take back control at the local state level. It begins with understanding, and we've already covered the educational issue. Be an advocate for constitutional principles. Don't worry about whether you can win or not. We won't know unless we try. The second step is this specific kind of action. Convention of States is a nationwide movement that offers a practical legal remedy for government overreach. You can learn all about it and sign the petition at www.conventionofstates.com. Article 5 of the United States Constitution allows our state governments to call for a convention of state representatives to remedy procedural shortcomings and restore the rule of law over federal officials. It's a legal strategy to return authority to citizens over the rich and powerful, restoring the checks and balances that protect our liberty. Do not be confused or fearful about a constitutional convention. Article 5 does not allow a general overhaul or rejection of the Constitution. It is specifically limited to making amendments to the current Constitution. Only specific amendments approved by each state's elected legislators can be considered. The most likely amendments to be considered are to require a balanced budget and the implementation of term limits for Congress. Since any amendment must be approved by 38 states, the chance of any radically negative amendment passing is virtually non-existent. Many Americans are discouraged that they can ever reverse the course of American government through a process of education. We're committed to the effort because it's the right thing to do. But most politicians and millions of Americans are okay with big government to provide all the services people have come to know and enjoy. It may take a catastrophe, a collapse, to force a course correction. But such a collapse would do great harm to the American people. However, there is one simple constitutional amendment that could prevent the collapse and force a course correction. Furthermore, it's an amendment that would make sense to the majority of Americans on both sides of the aisle. It's a balanced budget amendment that would say the federal government is prohibited from spending more this year than it received in tax revenue in the previous year. Naturally, since courts can decide many things regarding what constitutes a tax, the amendment would have to define what a tax is. Something like all fees paid by individuals and corporations through the Internal Revenue Service. The result of a balanced budget amendment would greatly reduce the amount of money available to spend and force the federal government to be more responsible in how it spends. It would become a smaller government by necessity. Maybe it disbands unnecessary departments like the Department of Education. There would be no more drama over increasing the debt limit since there would be no way to spend borrowed money. Maybe they would have to cut back on regulating local activities which the states can manage on their own. Cutting off the money would put everything in perspective, and the Federal Reserve would no longer be a source of newly printed money to supplement taxes. Might politicians try to increase taxes? Yes. But American voters, regardless of party affiliation, would object at the polls. This one amendment would return power to the people. So this is my take on the biblical citizenship classes. But one issue remains. Can Bible believers become inspired to actively participate in American politics? It seems to me that most churches have been in what I would call a soft decline for many years. By soft decline, I mean they have gradually lost members, lost reputation, lost influence, and lost motivation. When I talk with church leaders, many are uncertain about what role they play in leading congregations that are increasingly distracted while also being dissatisfied. A few national leaders have found a niche that gains them a following, but the fact that I can picture three or four of them in my mind is a testimony to their novelty among church leaders. The nature of modern Christianity is to look backwards with reverence and look at the presence with disdain. Biblical citizenship calls us to become the salt and light in our world that Jesus commanded. He said, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." My question for church leaders is, can you encourage your people to be renewed in their saltiness, to be the light in a dark world? There's no question that if we are to restore goodness to America, it must begin with people who understand what is good and have the will to strive for it. Thanks for joining us today. Until next time, go out and do good.